Your Honors, my name is John Poor. I represent Mr. Gerald Corder. With me at council table is Mike Keating. May it please the court and opposing counsel. This case poses a couple of interrelated questions of statutory interpretation under the Premises Liability Act. The first is whether the consent that is necessary to enter the property of another must be given expressly and contemporaneously under the Premises Liability Act, or whether consent may be inferred from conduct, custom, and prior history between the parties. And the second and related question is whether one who enters the property of another to return a borrowed item of personal property is a trespasser when he has, on numerous occasions, received permission to enter the landowner's property when the landowner was not there in order to provide a benefit or a service to the landowner. The appellant in this case, Gerald Corder, entered the backyard of his neighbor and friend, William Folds, in order to provide a benefit to Folds. Corder had borrowed a propane tank from Folds a day or two earlier with the expectation that it would be returned. Corder refilled the propane tank before returning it. The record in this case reflects that Folds had, on multiple occasions, given Corder permission to enter the property when Folds was not there in order to provide services or benefits to Folds.
I think it Folds was not at home when this event occurred, right?
Yeah, that is correct, Your Honor. Folds was not at home, but it's worth noting at this point that Corder had a key to Folds' home, and that he had been provided that key in order to provide.
But he didn't use the key to return the propane tank because his plan was to put it on the deck, which is what he did, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, Corder testified in his deposition, and it's reflected in the record that he didn't want to use the key.
Has that deposition been approved as a supplemental record in this case yet?
Yes, a portion of it was approved as a supplemental record in this case and was appended to the end of the record. And so there was an initial compact disc record that contained most of the original deposition testimony. And then there was a page or two that had been omitted, and that was appended to the end. And there was a reissued record that had those materials appended to the end.
Let me ask you a question.
Go ahead.
This is a propane tank, I gather, what, 5-pound tank that you use normally and associated from the grill?
Was this
returned to the Folds residence for the grill that was on his deck? I mean, was it just normal that you would place this tank back on the deck because it came from his grill?
Yes, Your Honor, that is basically what happened. And Corder testified that he had gone a day or two earlier, he'd run out of propane while barbecuing. And so he asked Mr. Folds if he could borrow a propane tank, received a propane tank from Mr. Folds, and he'd actually gone up to Mr. Folds' back deck in order to get the tank. And so Mr. Corder's reasoning was that he felt that the best and most appropriate way to return it was to put it back from the place from which he had borrowed it. And so that's what happened in that place.
No fence between the properties at this time?
Yeah, Mr. Folds' property was fenced, yes.
It's after this. After this event, it was fenced.
Well, the fencing project was a separate project that was a fence that was put up between the property of Mr. Corder and another neighbor with the assistance of Mr. Folds. So that wasn't a fence that was erected between the Corder property and the Folds property. The significance of that particular item, though, was that these two individuals had sort of a custom and a history of allowing one another access to each other's property for some sort of a legitimate reason. From Corder's standpoint, going on to Folds' property, that meant providing some sort of a service or a benefit to Folds. And Corder testified that they were friends, had a long-standing social relationship. Corder had the key to Folds' home, had used it in the past to perform a woodworking project in Folds' home, to adjust and to work on Folds' sprinklers when Folds had requested him to do that, to take care of miscellaneous problems in the home. And as Corder understood it, that this permission to enter the property extended whether or not Folds was necessarily there and whether Folds specifically said, you may come onto my land in a particular instance.
The question was, mm-hmm. Was there a fence on the day that Mr. Corder had to pass through to return the propane tank to Mr. Folds' deck?
Yeah, I believe he had to go through Mr. Folds' back gate. Is that correct?
Okay.
Okay.
And so Mr. Folds was not at home. Was he out of town for a period?
The record's not clear on whether he was out of town at the time or not. I don't believe that he was, because there wasn't, you know, any indication in the deposition testimony that he'd left town.
He just wasn't there when he went over.
Yeah. He wasn't there, and Mr. Corder felt that, you know, as a favor to his friend, he refilled the propane tank, and he also believed that he ought to try to return the propane tank in as expedient a manner as possible. And so that seemed like the best way to do it. And he testified in his deposition, you know, we were friends and I had a key to his house. So, you know, I've always been welcome at his house and in his backyard. I had no reason to think other than that. And that is in the appended corrected record on CD page 266, and that's page 77 of Mr. Corder's deposition.
How long had they been neighbors?
They've been neighbors for several years, I believe, since the early 2000s, at least. And so this was a long-standing relationship by the time of the incident.
I'm the statute counsel.
Certainly.
Did he have the express or imply, did he have permission or consent to go onto Mr. Folt's property? And if so, when did he get it?
Okay. Let me address that question in two parts. Concerning permission, the trial court's ruling applied the statutory definition of a trespasser, which is defines a trespasser as a person who enters or remains on the land of another without the landowner's consent. And a big part of the argument concerning the, sort of the erroneous ruling of the trial court in this case is that the trial court interpreted that term consent to mean only express consent, and held that basically because Fultz had never on this particular occasion said, yes, Mr. Corder, you may enter my property, that Mr. Corder did not have consent to go on to Fultz's property. Corder's position is that is erroneous, and that, well, Your Honor, you're correct that there was never an explicit conversation in which Mr. Fultz afforded Mr. Corder on this occasion permission to go on Mr. Fultz's property when Mr. Fultz was not home, and there was no express discussion of when or how the propane tank would be returned. The parties had a long-standing course of conduct in which they freely entered one another's property when it was for a legitimate purpose and to provide some sort of a service to the landowner. And the list of examples that I gave earlier, I think, provides evidence of that, that Corder had, you know, it had been understood between them for a long period of time that it was permissible to enter the other's property.
Was that reciprocal? And did Mr. Fultz come over to Corder's, on Corder's property without express consent?
Yeah, Corder testified that they borrowed things back and forth from each other frequently, and so he thought that Fultz had, I believe, returned things when he wasn't there. And also that the fence example is illustrative in the sense that when Mr. Fultz and Mr. Kowalenko, a mutual neighbor of the two of them, were constructing this fence, they, you know, adjoined and sort of abutted onto Mr. Corder's property, and Mr. Corder raised no objection to any of this, because this was sort of a piece with the history that had existed as between the parties.
Corder ever testified to having returned an object to Mr. Fultz's property and not having had an objection from Mr. Fultz?
He testified that he didn't recall specific instances in which he'd returned personal property when Mr. Fultz wasn't home, but his testimony was, I had a key to his house, I'm pretty sure that I did, in so many words, but I can't give you a specific example of when he did.
So why shouldn't consent be construed to be express consent?
Again, based on the long-standing course of history between the parties, and also based on sort of the history and the basic purposes of the premises liability.
How about a legal argument as to why consent shouldn't be limited to express consent?
Okay, certainly. Legal argument is as follows. The term consent, as it's typically used in the law, in the Black's Law Dictionary citation in Corder's reply brief, spells this out, typically includes both express and implied consent, or consent expressed in a manner other than words, or, you know, that can be inferred through conduct or prior custom. Secondarily, more specifically, in the premises liability context, it's commonly and historically been understood that the consent necessary to enter the property of another may be given expressly, or it may also be implied from prior conduct or course of conduct between the parties. For instance, in the second restatement of towards section 330, which defines a licensee, comment C The word consent indicates that the possessor is in fact willing that the other shall enter or remain on his land, or that his conduct is such as to give the other reason to believe that he is willing that he shall enter if he desires to do so. Comment E says that the consent which is necessary to confer a license to enter land may be expressed by acts other than words. Here again, the decisive factor is the interpretation which a reasonable man would put on the possessor's act. And I also, in conjunction with that, go ahead.
How are these helpful if supposedly the Premises Liability Act has done away with the common law or whatever notions of common law defenses or actions may have been there?
Certainly, Your Honor. A couple of responses to that. First is that an examination of the history of the premises liability statute and the purpose for which it was enacted sort of suggests that the statutory categories, while certainly not necessarily intended to wholly encapsulate the common law categories as they existed prior to the Mile High Fence opinion, suggests that the General Assembly was trying to restore a semblance of those categories. And you know, additionally, that was expressly drawn out and developed in the history of the 1986 Premises Liability Act, and then the 1990 Act retained status classifications that very closely match their common law antecedents, even though obviously the statutory definitions preempt any time there's any inconsistency between the definitions in any prior existing case law. It's also worth noting in this vein that Colorado courts have looked to the common law before to give meaning to the status classifications in the Premises Liability Act. A couple of examples of that. Martin v. Union Pacific Railroad, this court's opinion, 186 P3D at 69 through 70, explicitly considers the second restatement of torts to determine the status of an entrant after consent is revoked and evaluating how much time they have to get off property before they become a trespasser. This court's opinion in Chapman v. Willie, which is relied upon heavily by Folds, 134 P3D at 569 through 70, cites common law cases concerning the scope of consent and how to evaluate that.
These cases are cited in your brief, counsel?
Yes. And one additional one that I want to draw your attention is Lakeview Associates v. Mays, 907 P2D 580-583, and that's the Supreme Court opinion affirming this court's opinion. In footnote 4 of that opinion, the Supreme Court recognized that the definitions of licensee and trespasser and invitee closely matched the common law antecedents, notwithstanding the General Assembly's decision to insert in Section 1.5C language suggesting that they weren't necessarily trying to resurrect the common law category. So the upshot of all of that is that the language chosen by the General Assembly in defining the three categories of entrants very closely matches the common law antecedents, even though those categories were in some flux before Mile High Fence, and the General Assembly wasn't necessarily trying to recapture the precise contours of those categories immediately prior to Mile High Fence. And an examination of the history of premises liability and the use of the term consent in that area suggests that consent can be expressed in a multitude of ways. Express consent is one, but the trial court erred in holding that express consent is the only way to obtain consent to enter the property of another.
Under the definition of licensee, it says he can remain there pursuant to the landowner's permission or consent.
Yes.
The permission and consent have two different meanings. If so, what is permission and what is consent?
The way that court interprets the statute that's probably the most consistent with the statutory canon of giving meaning to all words in the statute is that permission means an affirmative statement of permission, means the actual conferral of permission, whereas consent is more in line with acquiescence, which implies that it could also be passive or implied.
Implied consent. Yep.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We have about a minute.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Terry Vasquez, and I represent the appellee, Mr. William Folds, in this matter. The facts of the case that lead up to us being here today are that Mr. Porter entered Mr. Folds' backyard to return a propane tank without Mr. Folds' permission, without Mr. Folds' knowledge that he would be there on that particular day, and without Mr. Folds' expectation that he would be there on that day.
It's consent.
without his consent.
Well, exactly. I didn't say that. That's what I was asking about.
Yes, it was without his consent.
Which of those words covers consent? You just used three words and you didn't say consent.
All of them in the context of this court's decision.
What's the difference between permission and consent? Or do you think those are just synonymous words that the legislature was loosely using in the definition of licensee, or do they mean two different things?
Actually, I don't know, and I haven't considered what the distinction is between permission and consent, because what we're here about today is the definition of trespasser. And those words are not used in the definition of trespasser. But what the legislature did use in the definition of invitee were the words express or imply. So when the legislature defined invitee, it said that it's somebody coming onto another's property for the purpose of transacting business, of which they're mutually involved in or interested in, or on someone's property where that property is held out to be by representation, either express or implied, to include an invitation or permission for the public to.
How does the use of the phrase express or implied in connection with the invitee help us understand the definition of licensee or the definition of trespasser? Doesn't the invitee, as the invitee, the duty is higher on the part of the landowner, right? That's the whole point of the statute. So, of course, the permission would be broader. You would think that. Where the duty is lower with respect to the licensee, I have to keep looking at the statute, and even lower with respect to the trespasser, you might expect a logical narrowing of the definition. The narrowest would be the trespasser. The broadest would be the invitee. The licensee is somewhere in the middle. Is that why they use two words, permission or consent?
Perhaps, yes. And that would make sense with the intent behind the premises liability statute, which was there's a couple of intents there. One was to protect landowners at where they weren't protected at common law. And that's what this court's reading of the statute, the definition of trespasser to include express consent only, does. It provides more protection for landowners rather than less. That's in line with the legislature's intent to protect landowners. It also, in Gallegos, the court stated that the intent was to reinstitute or relink a landowner's liability to his knowledge of a person's presence on his property and the reasons therefore. That does that here as well. We can, this court can make a decision that's in line with that intent by deciding that the consent needed in order to avoid being a trespasser is express consent.
Is counsel correct that in common law, implied consent was enough?
I don't agree with that, Your Honors. And in fact, there's no case cited by the appellant that demonstrates a court determining that the definition of trespasser in a premises liability context included implied consent. The case is cited in.
Why would a trespasser include implied
without consent?
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I thought that they cited several cases from other jurisdictions to that effect in their briefs.
They did, and with respect to those cases, every single one of them involved either a definition that had already been set forth either in the jury instructions or by other case law that included language that a trespasser is somebody on the property of another without the express or implied consent.
That's what common law is, a collection of cases that holds what the nature of the consent is.
Correct, and that's common law from other jurisdictions, but there's no indication that Colorado common law included implied consent.
Has it ever said to the contrary?
No, I think it's silent in that regard.
Has there been cases saying that the common law of other states is it does not include implied consent?
Yes. In fact, in the Ohio Court of Appeals, Florida Supreme Court, and Iowa Court of Appeals, in all of those cases, when those courts were facing the very issue here, whether the definition of trespasser is somebody without express or implied consent, the courts talked about the fact that You need some form of express consent, because otherwise you have a defendant who is faced with the duty to warn, because if there's implied consent, they're a licensee, and the duty is to warn people of dangers. But how can a defendant warn somebody of a danger on their property when they don't know they're on the property, when they don't expect the person to be on their property, and they have no expectation whatsoever? So in those cases, it talks about a landowner must know of that presence in order to fulfill the obligation of a duty to warn. And again,
the landowner must know of that presence of the trespasser.
Exactly.
Right. But if the person says, I'm there with consent, some form of consent, I'm not a trespasser.
Well, and that's where we get into, should there be some form of consent or should it just be express? It should just be express, because otherwise the landowner doesn't know that the person's presence on the property.
Doesn't the requirement of express consent upon each entry sort of fly in the face of the way people live, particularly neighbors? I mean, they go onto each other's property with some degree of regularity, if for another reason than being inadvertent.
Well, and I don't think neighbors go into gated and fenced backyards without knowledge or without some sort of prior consent.
I'm in my backyard, I'm throwing a ball for my dog to catch, it goes over to the fence in the neighbor's yard. I'd probably go over there and get it, and I think my neighbor would probably expect me to.
Okay.
I mean, this happens all the time with adjacent property owners, fence or no fence.
That might happen, but once a lawsuit was instituted and the legal rules for premises liability were put into place, you might fall into the category.
I understand the strictures of the statute, but I'm talking about, doesn't your construction of the statute ignore everyday life between normal neighbors? Who come onto each other's property with some regularity?
It may ignore some of the casual behaviors amongst neighbors, but on the other hand, it protects you as a landowner, which was intended by the legislature, if somebody is there without your knowledge and they get injured. So the court may be ignoring, or the legislature may have intended to ignore casual behaviors and interactions amongst neighbors, but the intent is not to restore or protect those relationships. The intent is to protect the landowner against unforeseen persons who are injured on their property, persons who they don't even have an opportunity to warn.
Unforeseen sounds to me like a question of fact. Sounds to me like, gee, maybe the relationship between the parties might have been allowing a basis for foreseeing that they could have been on the property. Sounds to me like a possible consent. Doesn't your construction of the statute add a word to the statute that's not there?
It doesn't, Your Honor. And in fact, appellant's argument is that we are seeking to add the word express into the language. Our argument is they are seeking to add the word implied into the statute.
Well, the court said express.
The trial court did. Yes.
And you're defending that whole order. I mean, you're arguing here it requires express consent.
I'm arguing twofold, Your Honors. First is it requires express consent. And just to address your question for a moment, if the court is going to decide if one word over the other should be read into the statute, it should be the word that provides for more protection to the landowner.
Well, if we decide one word over the other, I don't think their construction says one word over the other. I think they say you can have express or implied consent,
which would be reading that language into the statute, especially considering that when in the definition of invitee, the legislature specifically used that phrase, express or implied.
Express or implied, and what did it preface?
Representation that the public is invited or expected to come onto the property.
Express or implied representation?
Yes.
Okay, that didn't say express or implied consent.
No, it did not use the word consent. It was representation that the public is invited or expected. That's part of my argument, is that the statute should be construed to mean express consent. The second part of it is that the trial court did make some factual findings. the court found that the parties' prior interactions with each other did not give Mr. Corder permission on the date of loss to enter the backyard.
This is summary judgment, though, isn't it?
It was a motion for determination of law, and I believe it's the Chapman case in a very similar situation where the court's obligation and duty is to decide the status of the entrant. But the Chapman case said it's a mixed question of fact and law.
In a summary judgment or determination of law context?
Yes.
Seems to me as determination of law has to be undisputed material facts subject to essentially only one inference. Same thing for summary judgment, undisputed material facts subject to only one inference.
And I think those facts were...
So in other words, fact findings by the trial court are not that important in this particular context, are they?
Well, I think the court had to make some factual findings in order to apply the law and make a legal determination as to Mr. Corder's status. And in fact, the Chapman case said just that. It's a mixed question of fact and law. And here the court determined that the prior interactions between the parties did not give rise to permission on the day of in question. The court also stated that the prior interaction of the parties did not, Mr. Corder's permission to be on Mr. Fold's property in the past may have been so, but when he entered without Mr. Fold's knowledge, he entered and exceeded that scope of permission that had previously been given. The facts of their interactions are, yes, Mr. Corder had a key, but Mr. Corder admits that that key was supposed to be used when he was doing some projects inside the home. The key was supposed to be used if there was some sort of emergency or when Mr. Folds was away.
Well, if you're trying to say that the trial court found that he didn't even have implied consent, wouldn't all these different factual inferences be a question for the jury to determine if it was an issue of implied consent?
Not for the purposes of the premises liability statute, because the court is required to make the legal determination as to the status. So the trial court has to look at the facts in front of it and from those facts make a determination as to status. The jury cannot determine the status of a plaintiff in a premises liability action.
Side the underlying question, was there consent?
Well, I think that's the court's determination as well under Chapman. The Chapman court statement that this is a mixed question of fact and law proper for the judge's determination.
Was that in the context of a summary judgment or a determination of question of law?
Yes, it was a summary judgment, I believe, and it was specifically the court's determination of the status of a plaintiff in a premises liability context. Also, the appellants argued that the parties had entered each other's property numerous times while the other was not home, not factually supported by the record. Mr. Corder admitted that he could not think of one single time where he returned something to Mr. Folds outside of Mr. Folds' presence and when Mr. Folds was not there. The only evidence that Mr. Corder was at Mr. Folds' home without Mr. Folds being present was when he was using the key, as he was given permission to do work inside the premises. Also, the question was asked as to whether this tank was being delivered to the grill out on the backyard. And yes, that's true. And you might expect that that's where a tank goes. But it's important to note that Mr. Corder, when he borrowed the tank, he didn't come through the backyard and go up those deck steps and up to the deck. He came through the front of the house and he left through the front of the house. So there's nothing about the borrowing of the tank in and of itself that would have led Mr. Folds to believe that Mr. Corder may at some point, at some unknown time, enter his backyard and return the tank. Unless the court has other questions, I believe I'm out of time anyway.
Well, if Mr. Corder had called him and said, can I return your tank? He said, sure, drop it off tomorrow. We wouldn't be here today.
We probably wouldn't be here today.
But he didn't call me just to return the tank, and now we're here today.
Yeah, and the court argued that Mr. Corder wanted to return the tank expeditiously, but there were no discussions about that, and Mr. Corder admits that Mr. Folds never gave him a timeline as to when he wanted it back. There were never any discussions about when or where to return it, and I believe Mr. Folds was simply at work, just hadn't gotten home yet when Mr. Corder returned the tank. So had there been other discussions, had there been an expectation of Mr. Mr. Corder's presence on the property, we likely would not be here today. Thank you.
You need a lawyer before you visit your neighbors.
Yes, I guess. Carlos, I'll try to be brief, and I apologize for my scratchy throat here. I just want to cycle back very quickly to the standard review because I think it's important to emphasize what we are deciding. This case was decided on a CRCP 56H motion for determination of law. That motion should be granted only if there is no disputed issue of material fact. In this case, at a minimum, there's a disputed issue about the scope of the consent and the nature of the consent as to whether Corder had Folds' consent to be on the property on that date. Corder felt that he did. Folds felt that he didn't.
That was my question. So how are you supposed to do this? Because the statute says the court has to decide the status. I ask if they could, the jury can decide just the underlying question, was there consent, was there not consent? But then they have to be given instruction. Is it express consent, is it implied consent? So it seems to me it's always going to come back to a question of law, counsel. I thought that it would be an answer.
Here is the, just the basic procedure. The statute provides that the court has to determine the status of the entrant, and the jury has to determine status, has to determine liability. But the Chapman case that opposing counsel cites, the procedure in that case on page 568 of the Chapman case is that the case was tried to a jury, and then at the conclusion of the evidence, the trial court ruled that the plaintiff had been a trespasser at the motel where he was injured. So the court heard live testimony, was able to make credibility determinations and find facts before determining that the party was a trespasser. In this case, there have been no live witnesses, there has been no trial, and to the extent that the trial court resolved disputed issues of fact concerning the scope of the consent that Corder had to go on to Folds' property, the trial court erred, and this court should reverse and remand for further proceedings on that.
Don't we still have to define the meaning of the term consent in the statute? Otherwise, the court's going to come back to the same place she was already at, isn't she?
Yeah, Your Honor, most certainly you do, but again, the term consent without more is silent on the question of whether consent should be expressed or implied. Corder's position is that the most consistent, meaningful way to interpret that in accordance with the canons of statutory construction is to hold that it includes both express and implied consent, given the absence of any modifier selected by the General Assembly.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for their arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.